Out on his left the owl called again, and his teeth chattered in his head so that the sound was magnified painfully in his ears. Mark rolled over and peered blindly in the direction of the hooting owl, trying to force back the darkness, blinking the sweat that stung like salt in his eyes. It was like looking down a long, dark tunnel to light at the end, or through the wrong end of the telescope. Something moved on a field of golden-brown grass, and he tried to force his eyes to serve him, but his vision wavered and burned. There was movement, that was all he was sure of. Then silent meteors of light, yellow and red and green, exploded across his mind and cleared, and suddenly his vision was stark and brilliant, and he could see with unnatural, almost terrifying clarity. A man was crossing his flank. A big man, with a head round and heavy as a cannonball. He had a restless shoulders and a thick bovine neck. Mark could not see his face. It was turned away from him, yet there was something dreadfully familiar about him. He wore a bandolier over his shoulder, over the khaki shirt with military-style button-down pockets, and his breeches were tucked into scuffed brown riding boots. He carried a rifle at high port across his chest, and he moved with a hunter's cautious, exaggerated tread. Mark's vision began to spin and disintegrated again. He blundered to his feet, dragging himself up the stem of the knob thorn, and one of the sharp, curved thorns stabbed deeply into the ball of his thumb. The pain was irrelevant, and he began to run. Behind him there was a shout, the view halloo of the hunter, and Mark's instinct of survival was just strong enough to direct his feet. He swung away abruptly, changing direction, and he heard the bullet a split second before the sound of the shot. It cracked in the air beside his head like a gigantic bullwhip, and after it the secondary brittle snapping bark of the shot. Mauser, he thought, and was transported instantly to another time in another land. Some time-keeping instinct in his head began counting the split instants of combat, tolling them off even in his blindness and sickness, so that without looking back he knew when his hunter had reloaded and taken his next aim. Mark jinked again in his stumbling, unseeing run, and again the shot cracked the air beside him, and Mark unslung the P-14 from his shoulder and ran on. Suddenly he was into trees, and beside him a slab of bark exploded from a trunk, torn loose by the next Mauser bullet, in a spray of flying fragments and sap, leaving a white wet wound in the tree. But Mark had reached the ridge, and the instant he dropped over it, he turned at right angles, doubled up from the waist, and dogged away, seeking desperately in the gloom for a secure stance from which to defend himself. Suddenly he was deafened by a sound as though the heavens had cracked open and the sun had fallen upon him. Sound and light so immense and close that he thought for an instant that a Mauser bullet had shattered his brain. He dropped instinctively to his knees. It was only in the silence that followed that he realized lightning had struck the ironstone ridge close beside him, and the electric stench of it filled the air around him. The rumbling echo of thunder still muttered over the blue wall of the escarpment, and the huge, bruised masses of cloud had tumbled down out of the endless blue vault of the sky to press close against the earth. The wind came immediately, cold and swiftly rushing, thrashing the branches of the trees above him, and when Mark dragged himself to his feet again, it billowed his shirt and ruffled his hair, inducing another fit of violent shivering. It seemed the sweat on his face had been turned instantly to hoarfrost. In the rush of the wind, an owl hooted somewhere close at hand, and it began to rain again. In the rain, ahead of Mark, there was the gaunt, tortured shape of a dead tree. To his fever-distorted eyes, it had the shape of an angry warlock, with threatening arms and twisted frame, but it offered a stance, the best he could hope for at this exposed moment. For a few blessed moments, the darkness behind his eyes lightened, and his vision opened to a limited grey circle. He realized that he had doubled back and come up against the river. The dead tree against which he stood was on the very brink of the sheer high bank. The river had undercut its roots, killing it, and in time would suck it into the flood and carry it away downstream. At Mark's back the river was already high and swift and brown with rainwater, cutting off any retreat. He was cornered against the bank while the hunters closed in on him. He knew there was more than one, The owl calls had been signals, just as they had on the escarpment of Ladyburg. Mark realized that perhaps his only hope was to separate them and lead them unsuspecting on to his stance. But it must be quick, before the fever tightened its hold on his sense. He cupped one hand to his mouth and imitated the sad, mournful call of the Scops owl. Then he leaned back against the tree and held the rifle low across one hip. Off on the right, his call was answered. Mark did not move. He stood frozen against the tree trunk, and his eyes swiveled to the sound, and his forehead creased in his effort to see clearly. Long minutes drew out, and then the owl hoot came, even closer at hand. The rain came now on the wind, driving in at a steep angle, ice-white lances of slanting rain, tearing at the bush and open grassland beneath it, hammering into Mark's face with sharp needles that stung his eyelids, and yet cleared his vision again, so that he could see into the swirling white veils of water. Carefully, Mark cupped his mouth and hooted the owl call, bringing his man closer. "Where are you?" a voice called softly. "René, where are you?" Mark swiveled his eyes to the sound. A human figure loomed out of the sodden trees, half obscured by the sheets of falling rain. "I heard your shots. Did you get him?" He was coming towards Mark, a tall, lean man with a very dark brown, sun-scorched face, deeply lined and wrinkled around the eyes, with a short, scraggy growth of grizzled hair covering his jowls. He carried a Lee Metford rifle at the trail in one hand, and a rubber ex-army gas cape draped over his shoulders, wet and shiny with rain. A man past the prime of his life, with the dull, unintelligent eyes and the coarse, almost brutal features of a Russian peasant. The face of one who would kill a man with as little compunction as he would slit a hog's throat. He had seen Mark against the dead tree trunk, but the swirling rain and the bad light showed him just the dark, uncertain shape, and the call of the owl had lulled him. "René," he called again, and then stopped, for the first time uncertain, and he squinted into the teeming rain with those flat, expressionless eyes. Then he swore angrily, and tried to bring up the Lee Metford, swinging it across his belly and wiping the safety catch across with one calloused hand. "It's him," he recognized Mark, and the dismay was clear to see on his face. "No," Mark warned him urgently. But the rifle barrel was coming up swiftly, and Mark had heard the metallic snick of the safety catch, and knew that in an instant the man would shoot him down. He fired with the P-14 still held low across his hip. The man was that close, and the shot crashed out with shocking loudness. The man was lifted off his feet, thrown backwards with the Lee Metford spinning from his hands, hitting the rocky ground with his shoulder blades, his heels kicking and drumming wildly on the earth, and his eyelids fluttering like the wings of the trapped butterfly. The blood that streamed from his chest soaked into the sodden material of his shirt and was diluted immediately to a paler rose pink by the hammering raindrops. With a final spasm, which arched his back, the man subsided and lay completely still. He seemed to have shrunk in size, looking old and frail, and his lower jaw hung open, revealing the pink rubber gums of a set of tobacco-stained false teeth. The rain beat into the open, staring eyes, and Mark felt a familiar sense of dismay, the cold, familiar guilt of having inflicted death on another human being. He had an irrational desire to go to the man, to give him succour, though he was far past any human help, to try to explain to him, to justify himself. The impulse was fever-borne, and carried on wings of rising delirium. He was at the point now where there was no clear dividing line between fantasy and reality. "You shouldn't have," he blurted. "You shouldn't have tried. I warned you, I warned." He stepped out from the shelter of the dead tree trunk, forgetting the other man. The man that his senses should have warned him was the most dangerous of the two hunters. He stood over the man he had killed, swaying on his feet, holding the rifle at high port across his chest. Hobday had missed with his first three shots, but the range had been 200 or more, and it was uphill shooting, with intervening bush and tree and scrub, snap shooting at a running, jinking target, worse than jump shooting for kudu in thick catbush, a slim, swift human shape. He had fired the second and third shots in despair, hoping for a lucky hit before his quarry reached the crest of the ridge and disappeared. Now he could follow only cautiously, for he had seen the rifle strapped on the boy's back, and he might be lying up on the ridge, waiting his chance for a clear shot. He used all the cover there was, and at last the sheets of falling rain, to reach the rocky crest, at any moment expecting retaliatory fire, for he had shown his own hand clearly. He knew the boy was a trained soldier. He was dangerous, and Hobday moved with care. His relief when he reached the crest was immense, and he lay there on his belly in the wet grass, with the reloaded Mauser in front, peering down the reverse slope for a sign of his quarry. He heard the owl hoot out on his left, and frowned irritably. "Stupid old bastard," he grunted, pissing himself with fright still. His partner needed constant reassurance, his old nerves too frayed for this work, and he used no judgment in timing his contact calls, the damn fool. He must have heard the shots, and known the critical stage of the hunt was on, yet here he was, calling again, like a child whistling in the dark for courage. He brushed the man from his thoughts and concentrated on searching the rain-swept slope, until he froze with disbelief. The owl call had been answered, from his left, just below the crest. Hobday came up on his feet, crouching low. He worked swiftly along the crest. He saw solid movement in the grey, wind-whipped scrub, and dropped into a marksman's squat, drawing swift aim on the indistinct target, blinking the rain out of his eyes, waiting for a clean shot, and then grunting with disappointment as he recognised his own partner, bowed under the glistening wet gas cape, moving heavily as a pregnant woman in the gloom beneath the rain cloud and dense overhead branches. The man paused to cup his hand over his mouth and call the mournful owl hoot again, and the bearded hunter grinned. "Decoy duck," he whispered aloud, "the stupid old dog." And he felt no compunction that he was going to let his ally draw fire for him. He watched him carefully, keeping well down on the skyline, the silhouette of his head and shoulders broken by the low bush under which he crouched. The old man in the gas cape called again, and then waited, listening, with his head cocked. The reply called him on, and he hurried forward into the wind and the rain, drawn on to his fate. Hobday grinned as he watched. One share was better than two, he thought, and wiped the clinging raindrops of the rear sight of the Mauser with his thumb. Suddenly the old man checked and began to swing up the rifle he carried, but the shot crashed out, and he went down abruptly in the grass. Hobday swore softly, bitterly. He had missed the moment, had not been able to place the spot from which the shot had been fired. Now he waited with a finger on the trigger, screwing up his eyes again against the rain, less certain of himself, feeling a new awe and respect for his quarry, and the first tingle of fear. It had been a good kill, that one, leading the old man right in close, calling him up as though he were a hungry leopard coming to the bleat of a duiker horn. Then suddenly the bearded hunter's doubts were dispelled, and for an instant he could hardly believe his fortune. Just when he had been steeling himself for a dangerous and long-drawn-out duel, his quarry stepped out into the open from the cover of a twisted dead tree trunk on the bank of the river, a childlike, ridiculously artless act, an almost suicidal act, so ingenuous that for a moment he feared some trap. The young man stood for a moment over the corpse of the man he had killed. Even at this range, it seemed as though he swayed on his feet, his face very pale in the weak grey light, but the khaki of his shirt standing out clearly against the backlighting from the surface of the river. It needed no fancy shooting. The range was less than 150 yards, and for an instant Hobday held his aim in the centre of the boy's chest. Then he squeezed off the shot with exaggerated care, knowing that it was a heart shot. As the rifle pounded back into his shoulder, and the brittle crack of the Mauser stung his eardrums, he watched the boy hurled backwards by the shock of the strike, and heard the bullet impact with a jarring, solid thud. Mark never heard the Mauser shot, for the bullet came ahead of the sound. There was only the massive shock in the upper part of his body, and then he was hurled backwards with a violence that drove the air from his lungs. The earth opened behind him, and as he fell there was the sensation of being engulfed in a swirling vortex of blackness, and he knew for just a fleeting moment of time that he was dead. Then the icy plunge into the swirling brown current of the river caught him and shocked him back from the edge of blackness. The water engulfed his head, and he had the strength to kick away from the muddy bottom. As his head broke the surface, he dragged precious air into his crushed, burning lungs, and realized that he held the P-14 in both hands still.